There was a great saint who lived and died around 1960, maybe a little later than that. And he was known simply as Swami Rama, Ram Das. There's an American man, Richard Alpert, who has subsequently had the name Ram Das, but this was the first Ram Das, the Indian man. Ram Das means a devotee of the Lord, servant of the Lord. Ram Das was a very, his approach to God was very straightforward and very simple. I never met him. Swami Kriyananda met him. He actually came to America, and Swami Kriyananda hosted him in Southern California and spoke of meeting him. He was a small man, round, bald, and fairly toothless by the time Swami met him. And because his reputation had preceded him, Swami Kriyananda talked about when he first met him, he was accompanied by another Indian man who'd traveled with him, who would sort of fit the image of what you would think of a powerful Swami to be. He was tall, he was stalwart, he was handsome. So when Swami Kriyananda sort of approached the two of them, he started to give his attention toward the bigger, more physically impressive fellow, and the guy kind of goes like this, you know, because the real guy was over here with this blissful smile. And Swamiji said as soon as, you know, he was with him, he felt what his energy was like. I don't know if these books are still available. He wrote two, Ram Das did. One of them is called World is God, and another one has a very similar title. They're definitely, they're compatible with what we're doing here and very inspiring. Ram Das tells the story of how he got the mantra, Om Ram, I think it was, something very, very simple. Just saying the mantra, Om, victory to Divine Mother, Jai Ram, whatever it was. And the more he became engaged in this as a devotee, the simpler and simpler his life got. And he would just repeat the mantra all the time. And eventually he wandered away from home and walked all over India. And he tells these stories of just, he just would repeat the mantra, and then one thing after another would happen to him. And all of it to him was a sort of incidental event, because the only consciousness he was in was this consciousness of Ram. He was a devotee of Lord Rama, a name for God. That was all he was doing. People would feed him, people would take him places, all sorts of things would happen. And this is a true story. I mean, people can talk about these things, but this man really lived it. When you read his story, you feel it. One of the things he talked about was how he was often able to do remarkable physical things. He tells a story about just climbing up a virtually sheer cliff and just sort of, here's a branch, and the way he would describe it, well, God gave me a branch here, and then there I was with no other place to go, and then there was a branch here, and there was a branch here. It took you a while to realize he was climbing a sheer cliff, because he was just going from point to point as God led him, which is really all of us are doing in our lives. We're going from point to point as God leads us. It's just that we're really, really busy in our minds while that's going on. Just like the Bhagavad Gita said, we don't have that one-pointed focus. Our mind is always slipping back into doing all these other things. A friend of mine who's been through a very difficult period in his life, of persecution from outside sources, misunderstanding, legal problems. He told me just yesterday that when he was born, his grandfather had a horoscope done for him. The precise time period of this happening, as it happened to him, was in his horoscope the day he was born. It lasted almost exactly 2 years and ended on the day the horoscope said it would end. Now, that's astrology, which is also a true science. I said, who was the astrologer? You know, that's really what you want to know, who could read the pattern of the heavens. But whenever you hear a story like, you think, why do I worry about anything? Why am I anxiously thinking that this endless repetition of all my little issues actually has the slightest effect on anything? You know, and we can take that either to be very depressed, or we can take that to be really quite cheery, because all we have to do is Ram, 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 Ram. The first time I read that book, World is God, I think is the one I was reading, I was in my mid-20s. I was living at Ananda Village. I was living in this little green trailer out in the very, very undeveloped reality of that rural community at that time. And I read about him climbing the cliff, and it was just, it was so exciting to me. I looked over and there was this tall pine tree. And I went out there and I went up that pine tree. I did, just branch by branch. And when I got to the top, I realized that I'm terrified of heights. I really was. This is the middle of the day. There is nobody around. I have rommed all the way to the top. But when I got to the top, I started thinking about a whole lot of other stuff. You know, I went up in minutes, literally. It must have taken me an hour to get down. I mean, I could never get my consciousness back to the consciousness that got me up the tree. I had to come down the tree on my own steam, so to speak. You know, gripping this one and gripping that one and not looking down. And oh my word, what a moment. Same person. You know, nothing had changed. Going up, going down, it was just the same, except that my point of focus had shifted. On one, I was just in the flow of God taking me wherever he wants to go, and in that, I had the capacity to do it. I mean, of course, the tree was not a hard tree to climb, so it didn't take great physical skill, but I had the capacity to go up that tree. And I was just the same person, but I lost the capacity to come down. That story that is in our reading today, which is from, it's from The Path, actually, Swami tells it, about Master being able to take those boys across the waterfall by that strong declaration of faith, and then they would go across. And then the just, you know, heart-chilling story of some teacher later doing it in some poor boy drowning. I have to say, I have always had a hard time exactly grasping that story. I mean, there it is, but what is that subtle nuance? You have to have real spiritual power, is how he puts it. And this other teacher did not have that same power. Well, Swamiji remarked once, we were on a pilgrimage tour, as it were, to Italy. And we went to the town of Siena, where they have the head of St. Catherine. In Kali Yuga, the age on this planet which has just passed, which everything is material, things are thought of very physically. And when these poor saints would die, the towns would compete to have some fragment of their physical body kept there, and then it would become a holy relic. Truth is, there is a lot of power in, I mean, if you're really going to hold, you know, the shirt or the shoe of some great spiritual person, well, he wore his body a lot longer, you know, so one of his bones or something is going to be permeated. It's a little morbid to our way of thinking. And, you know, oh, goody, let's go see Catherine's head. You know, it's not like you automatically think that's really a great thing to do. Or in Avila, you got to see St. Teresa's finger. I mean, it's not the way we think now. But nonetheless, the simple truth of the matter is a tremendous power. St. Catherine of Siena was a powerful saint. Master said, you can't study all the Catholic saints because many of them became saints in ways that are not consistent with self-realization. They became saints by desperately trying to convert pagans to the one true church and things like that that we don't adhere to so much. But St. Catherine of Siena communed with God. She was a pure mystic and she communed with God. She was pure self-realization, as Master would say. So there's a tremendous power there. And they also, there was another miracle that was done in Siena, which is at some point some evil person stole some of the consecrated hosts, the communion wafer. Somebody got some really bad karma and stole those communion wafers. And they're consecrated. They represent the body of Christ. It's a terrible thing to have them taken out of the atmosphere in which they're meant to be. So the story is told that the whole town prayed that they would be recovered. And then in a miraculous way, they were, or it was. And I think it's everlasting now. I think whatever the one was is still there and it's still whole. I might be making some of this up, but this is sort of the story as I remember it. Swami's comment was, a whole lot of restless prayers do not equal one focused prayer, basically. You can get a whole lot of people who don't have any spiritual training or capacity, even if they wish they did, you just mass amount of mediocre prayers doesn't make one good one. He said there must have been a saint praying, is how he put it. It was a very interesting statement, and I've always remembered that. Because we have to understand here, and this is what self-realization is, as opposed to the way religion used to be, so to speak. In the Bible, even, and especially as you go farther back, they're trying to use images that talk to us about power. Because those who actually experience the presence of God, and masters of self-realization exist in every culture and every time, no matter how low the age of the planet might be, that's merely the background for the individual drama of the soul self-realization. Jesus lived in a very low era on the planet. After all, he was crucified, and crucifixion was regularly done along the road. You know, if there was just like crosses laid out here on El Camino, and we'd come out and we'd watch people dying who were executed for this and that. That's literally what the times were. It's a very barbaric period of time. But he was nonetheless a saint of complete self-realization. There was no limitation imposed upon him by the setting. But in order to communicate, he had to say things that people would understand. So he talked about sheaves of wheat, and he talked about sheep being lost in ditches, you know, and things like that. Master talked about television and radio and automobiles and airplanes. Not because one is more or less spiritual, but it's because that's what we're thinking. Most of us really don't know what we would do if one of our sheep fell into a ditch on the Sabbath. You know, this is not something that we've had to think about, you know, very much. Okay? Now, just a second. I have to catch the thought there. It slipped out of my head. Oh, isn't that annoying? Oh, yes. So the image that was used a lot to try to convey what the saints experienced in terms of the power of God was kings. You know, even we call God, don't we call him now the King of Kings? When we sing the Messiah at Christmas time, King of Kings, and we sing it over and over again. Like, who knows how big a king is? Even in America, we don't really like have a big commitment anymore to kings. Except, isn't there one of those sports teams? I think there's a couple of sports teams that are called Kings, the remnant of it. So we live with, in the Bible, we live with this image of this is the power of God, is that he's a king. And so as a consequence, we're always asking him to help us, aren't we? But the feeling that we have of it is he has the power and we don't. But if we approach him in just the right way, that maybe we'll get something from him. This is especially true in the Old Testament. Jesus tried to fix it a little bit. If you ask of your father a loaf of bread, will he give you a stone? Jesus tried to sort of push this a little bit toward a more heart-oriented or a more compassionate way of understanding. He's not just a king, he's a father. He didn't quite make it to being a mother. It took until Yogananda got here for him to be a mother, for God to be warm enough to be feminine, because the age is advancing. So when we have this image in our mind, which many of us still carry, that God is this distant force, and that we propitiate him, and if he's pleased, then he gives us a little bit. That's the king image, isn't it? He can just go like this or like this, and we're never really quite sure what's going to move him to do it. But the true self-realization image, the reason Master has come to renew the teachings of Christ and to bring a new understanding for Dwapara Yuga, is that God is our very own. And that's why Jesus talked, Master talked about God as Divine Mother. And this the gender as we think of it, you know, female body, male body, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking streams of consciousness. And Master on one of his own tapes says, God, the mother is much closer to the father. When you pray to God as mother, he can't resist you. The perfect way to say it. He is the impersonal expression of the spirit. But when you call to that impersonal expression with your whole heart, with deep sincerity, he must respond. He turns into the mother. The mother becomes close. The mother is closer than the father. Has nothing to do with men and women. It has to do with the intimacy of what the feminine is like, the impersonal of the masculine, which is just the balance of the universe. Both are needed. If everything is personal, nothing ever progresses. If everything is impersonal, then the love aspect is missing. It's the yin-yang that we're all trying to work for, the perfect image, the perfect circle. So what Master's trying to teach us with that story about how he could take those boys across the waterfall, but somebody of lesser power couldn't, is someone else had not unified his consciousness with the power that was going to take them across. Because the power that was going to take them across is exactly the power that took me up the tree. You know that there's this awareness of moving in harmony with the universe, and everywhere you move, there's no self to be separated from it. It just moves in complete union with it. Where can there be injury? Where can there be separation? Where can there be missteps? This is not just a philosophical idea. This is the destiny that all of us are working toward. This is the point of prayer. This is the point of meditation, of chanting, of love, of devotion, of Kriya Yoga, of discipleship, is to take these thoughts and change them just from words on the paper, or isn't that beautiful, or isn't that perfectly expressed, to an actual experience of, oh, this is who I am. I am not separate. Swamiji, and something I read recently, was trying to explain the illusion of individuality and the experience that we have versus what the deeper reality behind it actually is. It's very, very difficult idea to grasp, because on the level on which we live, we appear and feel to be distinctly different from one another. But when we go deep into meditation, when we unite sometimes even as a group collectively, all of a sudden all of those edges just begin to go away. And when you, now the way they're able to measure energy and to see the subtler reality behind the material world, even the pictures we have of each other with this neat little body, we're not this neat little body, we're this energy force moving through and moving out from, and all the edges are all mixed up. They're just completely different. We all know that in our friendships, in our love relationships, that there's no neat edges. These forces just move together all the time. And so when we're always attuning ourselves to one or another of these realities, what we attune to is what we are. And the point of all of our spiritual practice, I was speaking about Swamiji describing this, what he was talking about, and he says, just imagine the ocean, the vast ocean of spirit, which is what we are. There is a vortex. Imagine some of that water whirling around a point of personal identification. So there's this personal point at which, in the midst of this ocean, I claim this little area of moving energy as mine. And because we hold that, because we're always emanating this idea, this is who I am, this is who I am. I was born at this time. These are my experiences. This is my past. This is my present. Because of this, this happens. Because of that, that happens. We hold that idea. Oh, this was my childhood. This is my adulthood. This is the disaster that happened to me. This is what I remember from a past life. This is what I want. This is what I don't like. And so it all just keeps whirling. But as soon as we recognize, oh, this is just the wave of energy and motion. I claimed it as my own, but there was never anything that made it mine except the idea in my mind. Someone said, it was repeated to me, but I thought it was so well put. We're always in the now. Everything that's happened to us in the past no longer exists. I mean, there's no way to go back to it. You know, you have the memory of how darling your children were when they were so little, and you could pick them up and take them where you wanted them to be. And now these big, hulking adults come into your house, and you remember. Swami Kriyananda gave his mother once a Mother's Day card, and it was a birthday card, I mean. And on the front of it, was this big, hulking kind of, really tough guy looking with tattoos and scars on his head and a bald head and just really like this. But he's dressed in a little sailor suit and he's holding a balloon like this. Happy birthday, mother, from your little boy. Because that is always the way it is. But there's no way you can go back to that. Absolutely no power on earth, heaven or earth. You cannot go back to it because it's gone. But we still have it. But what do we have? We have the story we tell ourselves in our own minds about it. That's all we have. We have the fact that we've claimed it, we've defined it, and we relive it. You know, for better or for worse, that's what we do. And as this person gave extremely good advice, change the story and you've changed reality. Because it's gone, right? So that's what we're always working with. We're just always working with what is it that keeps me small in the midst of infinity. What keeps me small in the midst of infinity is the fact that I keep rotating around these ideas. And as soon as that dissolves, we become part of the ocean. And simultaneously we realize we were never not part of the ocean. You know, the power that took me up the tree, which was my own experience, was just this fearless feeling that I am one with the tree. I can just go right up this tree. But when I got to the top, I lost it. I had faith going up, and I only had belief coming down. You know, I had faith that it was true coming up, and I sort of hoped that it was true coming down. Right? Master went across that waterfall. He knew that the power of God would take them across, that every one of those boys would be in that divine flow, and there was no possibility of a misstep. And then someone else came up there, and he hoped it was true. You know, there's a very fine line between presumption and faith, and this is a whole nother discussion I can't go into now. But what we really want to understand is that that kind of experience is possible. And we try and we fail, and we try and we fail, and we try and we fail, but eventually the tide does come in. And that's what we live for. It may start out only as a belief, but with enough experience, it becomes faith. And that faith, as Jesus tells us, will move mountains. Will move impossible things that we're absolutely certain can't even happen. Will happen by that power.